Les colloques du Collège de France.
Et maintenant, nous allons enchaîner par la table ronde. Et c'est la question est posée ainsi par Nicolas qui va l'animer. Where is Boulez now? Boulez now is here, on peut dire. En tout cas pour nos deux jours, mais voilà. Et la table ronde animée par Nicolas se fera avec nos intervenants Edward Campbell, Eric Drott, Jonathan Goldman et Catherine Lozada. Donc il y aura une certaine prédominance de la langue anglaise, mais vous serez tous attentifs et intéressés.
Donc nous avons une petite heure pour échanger sous forme de table ronde. Ça va se faire en langue anglaise, comme le disait Pierre Michel. Donc je vais tout de suite changer, essayer de rewire my brain. So the aim of this roundtable is certainly not to conclude or to offer a synthesis of the conference. It would not be an easy feat to achieve, and it's often quite hazardous or unsatisfying at the end of conferences like that. But I suggest that we try to update our view of Boulez and to connect the current debates that we've been having over the 2 days to the current dynamics of Boulez reception and Boulez research. This roundtable could be seen as a kind of projection space, an espace de projection for some of the thoughts that we've been airing. Boulez often insisted on the fact that he could have settled anywhere in the world, provided that he would benefit from excellent support and infrastructure for his projects, and he emphasized internationalism over localism and professionalism over amateurism. And this is why I think maintaining a narrow focus on the French and the Parisian aspect or scale or space for these two decades wouldn't be enough, and it's interesting to try to get back to the Parisian Boulez of the 70s, 80s, 90s from the outside, from abroad. So I asked our colleagues from Canada, the United States, and the UK to come here with some perspectives. From their own academic, musical, cultural, immediate environment, and to merge their perspectives. So this roundtable is made of two parts. The first part deals with Boulez's significance in the musical life today, and the second one is an opening up of research suggestions or wishes from each of you. So, Catherine Lozada, Jonathan Goldman, Eric Drott, and Eddie Campbell. And so each of them will talk for 3 or 4 minutes and make a point, and then we'll have a short discussion, and that two times. Let's start. So, Catherine, would you start? Just the green button.
Yeah. From his contentious article, Schoenberg is Dead, through his reflections on his own music late in life, Boulez consistently conveyed what I think should be the fundamental basis of his legacy, and that is the importance of always moving forward. A 2004 interview with Jürgen Otten encapsulates these ideas. When asked about his early and polemical article on Schoenberg, he summarizes his position. And here I'm quoting, "We have to go further than Schoenberg. Schoenberg was a classic of the 20th century, but we have to carry on after his death. In that same interview, when challenged about whether this same philosophy might sometimes be applied to him, Boulez coolly and explicitly states that it should. And he says, "One dies for oneself. The others want to carry on with their own lives. That doesn't bother me." Assessing the impact of his works, values, and ideas in the current cultural context, we must take into consideration the full connotations of this legacy, embodied in all aspects of his professional career, including his approach to teaching, programming, conducting, as well as his compositional aesthetic. In the interview I just mentioned, when asked about the influence of his works, Boulez clarifies that he never tried to influence other composers. "That's why I very rarely had students. I am of the opinion that young composers have to find and follow their own path," end quote. This points to how problematic it might be to measure Boulez's reception by aspects of influence. The same thing applies to trying to measure his impact by the sheer number of performances of his own works. Wonderful as these performances are when we get to experience them, we must remember that throughout his career as an impresario, and despite his mission as conductor of transforming the repertoire played by major orchestras across the globe, Boulez programmed his own works rarely. Instead, he founded institutions like IRCAM and the Ensemble Intercontemporain, specifically dedicated to enable the continuing performance of innovative work, giving long-lasting form to this idea of always moving forward. This concept is even embedded in the aesthetic conceptions of his work and his mature ideas of a work in progress. Right? For instance, the image of a spiral to reflect an evolving form, a work, quote, "that is finished and unfinished at the same time," end quote. He also states that the work is both finite and infinite. When Boulez discusses what it is like to perform Répond, he states, and here I'm quoting again, "Every time I perform the piece, I think there is further development. I project the piece into the future. The performance is only a moment of my life. This moment interests me far less than the continuation of the piece in the future," end quote. To conclude, I think the impact of Boulez's works, ideas, and values to a certain extent can be measured by the degree to which others have absorbed and moved beyond them, which in his own eyes would be a measure of their success.
Thank you.
I think it's Eddie next.
Eddie, yeah. You recognize your slide, yeah.
Après Brexit, je peux dire je suis 300% européen. Et j'ai le passeport le prouver. In English, I'm asked to speak about the dynamics of Boulez's recent and current reception in musical life in the UK. I'd first of all just remember, as I said yesterday, that Boulez first came to the UK, to Edinburgh, in 1948, to the Edinburgh International Festival, where he performed with Jean-Louis Barrault, playing the Onde Martineau in Hamlet. And he continued to come to the UK many, many times until his final performance at the Queen Elizabeth Hall in London in 2011, when he conducted Plis Sur Plis. And in the meantime, he had such a big connection with the UK, particularly in London and in Edinburgh. I was asked in an interview a few weeks ago, I did for a radio programme on Boulez, about performances of Boulez today. And it worried me that I didn't really have a strong idea of what was being done for his centenary year. So I actually made a list of all of the performances anywhere in the world that I could find that were being done. But I've synthesized this to the British performances, which are in the slides. And I'm not going to go through them all, but I think if you look at it, you cannot be but impressed by the number of works of Pierre Boulez that are being performed in the UK. The vast majority are in London. There's one in Cardiff, and I'm responsible in part for a little conference in Boulez that will be taking place in November in Edinburgh. When we went to the consulate at the consulate in Edinburgh, who has an office in the Institut Français, I was really shocked when he told me that they had two rooms which they called the Salle Boulez, which was really strange, that they would have, you know, chosen Boulez of all composers. There's also a conference in Leeds in November too, which is looking at the composers who have an anniversary in 25, which is Ravel, Satie, as well as Boulez. So there's a little place for Boulez in that. So all of these concerts, the disappointment is that Repon is not being performed, but all of the other big works are being performed by orchestra. One of the things which really impresses me at the moment, a real cause for optimism, is the number of conductors who are taking on the big works. And if I could just move outside of the UK and look at them. In 2005, Repon is being performed, conducted by Pierre Bleuze, Baz Vigors, Kent Nagano, Jonathan Knott, Norman Snay. It makes me think that really since the death of Boulez, that perhaps performers are thinking that his works are something that they can take on for themselves. Boulez always used to say that he did not like when other conductors conducted his work. It made him uneasy because he felt like a backseat driver. And there's that famous picture of him in the car, which he was given by Paul Zacher, speeding down the roads between Donaueschingen and Baden-Baden. Many ensembles are picking up on the smaller works as well, particularly Derivan and Memorial, which are becoming favourites. We had an ensemble from Paris in Edinburgh in November, the Defun Ensemble, with Rachel Kobliakov, who performed it, and Rachel is coming back in November to perform both versions of Antenne. I'm also the number of recordings of Boulez's music. I've been in Paris for the last week, and already I've discovered new recordings which I did not know existed. The number of recordings of the piano music, for example, it's becoming possible, perhaps for the first time, to imagine Boulez as a subject of one of those programs which every country has, where an expert compares recordings, for example, of the Troisième Sonate. That would not have been really possible before. Finally, I want to just pick up on the work of UK publishers. And I think UK publishers have really, as we say in English, punched above their weight in terms of representing Boulez. And once again, this is not at all nationalistic, but the work of Cambridge University Press, for whom Jonathan and I have our books, are with Cambridge, but equally now the work of Oxford University Press, and Faber and Faber, who brought out the most recent, the English translation of, I always want to say Jalon, but the English translation of Lisson, which Jonathan was involved with, very impressive volume. But going right back to the Pensez la musique aujourd'hui, translated by Richard Rodney Bennett and Susan Bradshaw as Boulez on Music Today, once again was Faber, the publication of Orientations. So all of these have taken place in England. And for me, I suppose the two big institutions would be the publishers and the BBC, which beyond the death of Boulez, it seems to me, have kept faith with his legacy. Just to say one thing, which is a cause for concern perhaps, is that I'm completely in favour of the broadening of university curricula. But with that, there's no doubt that space has become very pressed. And I think one of the areas which has perhaps suffered is the legacy of the post-war avant-garde. It's perhaps no longer so popular a subject, but also just finding time for all of that has become problematic in terms of communicating the music of this generation, including the music of Pierre Boulez, to the young.
Thank you, Eddie.
So I didn't fulfill the brief and provide bullet points, but some images instead. First, the good news. Eddie, I was kind of curious what's happening in the United States to mark the centenary of Boulez, and I was pleased to find that there are a lot of concerts and concert series that are being dedicated to him this year. Some of them are perhaps to be expected, Chicago Symphony Orchestra, Cleveland Orchestra, New York Philharmonic may be a bit more restrained, and then throughout the country, LA Philharmonic, a number of university new music ensembles are having events to mark the anniversary. So that's the good news. The not so great news is that I think that there's an open question in the United States right now about what Boulez's stature is apart from this centenary. I mean, I put up the Google Scholar Ngram, which I obviously this is not to be trusted. This is not. I would not submit this as evidence for anything, but it does give you a sense of the overall kind of drop-off in mentions of Boulez in English language sources over the years. Unfortunately, I think that this is a real phenomenon that we have to contend with. And as I say, though, in the few bullet points that I did provide, I don't think this is Boulez's fault or the fault of his music. I think it has more to do with changes in U.S. culture over the past 30 years and that have accelerated, well, in the last few months, if I'm going to be very, very frank. There is a growing kind of anti-intellectualism, a growing hostility to a certain kind of culture and a certain kind of set of cultural values. And I think the thing that is particularly pernicious here is it's not just that, the kinds of values that once were invested in a figure like Boulez and could elevate him, make him somebody who, when I lived in the sort of New York area 30 years ago, it was quite common to see discussion of him on the pages of the New York Times and the New Yorker and these kinds of outlets. But I think that the problem is also that the broader sort of system by which a figure like Boulez is invested with value in the United States has eroded, such that I do feel that there's like almost a loss of utopian value of autonomous culture in the United States. The idea that this could provide an alternative to the status quo, a different way of experiencing the world. Some of those values of the historical and then the post-war avant-garde have been gradually chipped away. And I think it's instructive to compare what people call now the second Gilded Age to the first Gilded Age, when wealthy robber barons tried to launder their reputations by building museums, building concert halls, building libraries. We see none of that happening right now in the United States. What's happening is the destruction of universities, the destruction of cultural institutions. It's with that kind of, I'm sorry, I apologize, but I'm trying to be honest here. It's on that kind of negative, potentially, note that I do think that, this gives us work to do, right? It is up to us to actually undertake the work of reconstructing this culture, of rediscovering these values. And it's why I put this quote from Pierre Bourdieu up here, something that I'd read maybe 20 years ago, one of his last writings, La culture est en danger. I think La culture est encore plus en danger maintenant. But I think that he's quite right, that to a certain extent, it is the sort of person who occupies the most sort of vanguard and autonomous position, who represents the kind of limit case for what we need to safeguard and protect. I think that that's what I see as the work to be done in the years to come.
Thank you, Eric. And then Jonathan.
Yes, so I always find it hard to gauge things like that. What is the reception? What is the without having the figures to back it up? But I will say that I wrote a book review on a couple books on Boulez last year. And so this was before the Boulez centenary started. And I just started the introduction to my review saying that, well, for those of us who grew up in the, let's say, the 80s and 90s, when all those heroes of modernism were alive and they seemed like these, you know, these gods, these living gods around us, they ruled the musical landscape, that it had been strange the last 10 years, let's say since almost 10 years since Boulez's death. Now almost all of those heroes of modernism are gone now, and I found, in not counting these the performances linked to the centenary this year, that there was a lull, that I did not hear much about Boulez and his contemporaries in contemporary musical life, by which I mean recordings, playlists, concerts, people being newspapers and magazines and things like that. I bet I'm not the only person here who has a Google alert on the name Boulez. Je suis en seul endroit au monde probablement où il y a d'autres gens ici comme moi ont un Google alert pour le nom de Boulez. Ai-je raison? Mais j'ai constaté que depuis plusieurs années maintenant, que les alertes de Google que je reçois, et c'est pas empirique, c'est pas scientifique, de même que le n-gram que tu nous as montré, Eric, j'ai constaté que dernièrement, avant le centenaire, que la plupart du temps, qu'il y avait un item où le nom de Boulez figurait dans les éléments de nouvelles que Google m'envoyait, je constatais que les articles se rapportaient à des concerts ayant lieu ou à une ou l'autre des salles Boulez à Paris ou à Berlin, et pas à la musique de Pierre Boulez. Et d'ailleurs, dans le n-gram que tu as là, à mon avis, il y a cette distorsion-là, due au fait que plusieurs de ces occurrences se rapportent à la salle et pas à la personne. And so I found that a bit discouraging, although maybe this centenary year is the year of consecration, and we're seeing something where Boulez is being recognized as a 20th century classic. I wasn't sure. This is what I wrote in that review that precedes all the centennial celebrations, many of which I wasn't aware of. I said a hopeful take for Boulez and his cohort might diagnose the present time as a requisite purgatory that precedes ultimate consecration in the pantheon. But this doesn't have the ring of truth to it. Boulez, Stockhausen, and their contemporaries were already so confident of their roles in a world historical project that for one to expect a second consecration to come later by the hands of others. They were so much in charge of their own destiny, it seems like to me, to expect others to take on that role. Mais peut-être que j'ai tort, I don't know. But just to very quickly talk about the element that I have, the slide that I put up here, it brings us back into the academy. So je parle de la réception, pas nécessairement dans la vie musicale de tous les jours, mais plutôt au sein de l'académie. J'ai trouvé instructif d'aller voir du côté de l'histoire de l'art, bon, une discipline proche de celle de la musicologie, pour voir comment dans l'histoire de l'art on parle aujourd'hui de l'avant-garde, l'avant-garde d'après post-45. Et j'étais très étonné, j'ai vu un appel à des propositions pour une conférence qui aura lieu l'an prochain, je crois, en histoire de l'art, où dans l'introduction de la proposition de la thématique du colloque, l'auteur nous écrit ce que vous voyez là. The post-1945 neo-avant-garde further moved into New York and North America more generally, often seen as the advance guard of modernism in the West and as synonymous with a white imperialist, if not outright racist, primitivizing artistic undertaking that apparently held that only the West is equipped with a cultural advanced guard. The avant-garde in the 1980s and 90s got lumped on the baggage train and was sent off. If mention was still made of the avant-garde in critical debates on contemporary art, it was either in derogatory terms or to signal that the moment of the post-avant-garde had arrived. So I was somewhat surprised that, in musicology, I don't think it's the case that we have rejected this post-war avant-garde as a viable category, although it has occurred to some extent. You see it, in a marvelous book like Benjamin Pickett's Experimentalism Otherwise, where he talks about how the experimentalism of a Cage or Stockhausen was defined in contradistinction to improvisatory experimental traditions of free jazz, for example, and that those barriers and borders were made along racial lines in most troubling of ways. But we still use this category of the avant-garde, I was surprised to see that. And so this conference then obviously is trying to recover in some way, rehabilitate find a place for the, regain a use for this term avant-garde. So I was interested to show this to my colleagues and audience to see what they thought about that how that how we think of that in our discussion about music, or don't we?
So if I try to find a common thread between most of your talks, that's a huge work. I noticed that you repeatedly asked whether the fate of Boulez himself was linked to the fate of new music or avant-garde music in general. So to which extent Boulez is typical from the fate of new music that would be receding, that's the point, or would he have a different status? Listening to Eddie talking about the way younger or new conductors take up the gauntlet and play Boulez's pieces anew, with fresh insights, I would say that perhaps in this respect he has different status, and that would be linked to what you said, which is that he worked hard to build up an infrastructure. There's a long-standing history of Boulez and some of the capitals we are dealing with, and that would not be the case of some other composers, even the very famous one of the same generation, like Nono or Berlioz. What do you think of that? Some of you who would like to respond. Yeah, Eddie, yeah.
I think it's, to some extent, you can see Boulez at work in his final years. It was mentioned yesterday, the Deutsche Grammophon project of the 13 CDs, but also the work he did in the Lucerne Festival Academy as well, where he had such an opportunity to work with and to teach and transmit so much to so many young people. The wonderful video which was made from that, the way that every young person who was interviewed spoke about, this was not like a grandfather, never mind a father, this was almost like a friend who was speaking to them in a paternal father, in a friendly way about what they were doing and encouraging. And when you speak to composers as well, I mean, like Dai Fujikura, for example, every composer, you hear Matthias Pincher, all of these composers who had some dealings with Boulez, they always say there was never a critical word about, he wasn't interested in did they use multiplication processes or what their rhythmic processes were. He seemed to have a remarkable capacity to actually, I mean, obviously he made quality choices. He obviously had made choices that a piece was worth his consideration or not. But after that, he seemed to be very able to work with people and to inspire.
That can be connected to what Catherine said at the outset, that he was kind of an impresario for others. Yeah. So he would have developed that capacity, yeah.
Just on, in terms of how he's faring with regard to the others, I would say that perhaps Ligeti of the generation is the composer who has perhaps captured the concert platform, perhaps more than Boulez. And as a full-time composer, well, he taught, but nevertheless he composed many more works than Boulez, and his But he seems to, I would say, was having more success. But on the other hand, I think Messiaen's music has come into the public domain, and arguably Messiaen's musical language is as difficult in some ways as that of Boulez, but yet people seem to have got beyond its own particular peculiarities to embrace it. And that makes me feel that there's no reason why En Termes de, for example, would not be a piece that, and many other pieces, the notation for orchestra. I think part of the problem with Boulez is so many of the pieces have very particular demands. To play Police à l'Emplate, you need to have a very big orchestra. It costs a lot of money. To play Rituel or Figure Double Prism, you need to organize your musicians in particular ways, which make these pieces perhaps difficult to program.
Could I'll just push back against that just slightly, Eddie, and say that yes, of course, putting on a piece like Répond requires huge demands on specific halls, and not to mention electronics. But in terms of Boulez's use of electronics, if you compare it to other composers like Stockhausen, for example, just to name one, Boulez is always very careful in his approach to electronics to describe in words what electronic processes he wishes to produce. And well, maybe Andrew, I'm sure, will have something to say. He will either agree or disagree with what I'm saying, but in a way that he favors electronic processes that can be described in words, which I think in a way is a bet on the future that people will be able to assemble with the technology of their future, be able to recreate these works by following those verbal descriptions. Whereas if you look at Stockhausen's pieces, electronic pieces, they have a list at the beginning with photographs of the different equipment that he requires you to use in the pieces. And there's, of course, their equipment that does not exist anymore today, 20, 30, 40, 50 years on. So maybe there is, the music is a little bit more accessible, more open to performances. And I know of even students, very low budget performances of En Termes de that have taken place at US universities, for example, where graduate students have prepared the electronics themselves and that kind of thing.
Talking about students, I mean, I remember this this quote that you gave Catherine, others want to carry on with their own lives, and so he remits himself the fate of his music, and the music of others would be in the hands of other people with other aims, other objectives. So it's no the younger generation. There's a huge evolution or change of taste, of cultural tastes. What do you, from your own positions as professors, as teachers, how do you feel this new generation is taking up or not aspects of Boulez music, be it as listeners or performers, as Jonathan just said? Some of you. No. No, they don't listen at all.
I don't teach composition, but I teach a number of composers, since in the past I've taught, I've been sort of tasked at my university with teaching survey courses on contemporary music, and they are few and far between, but there are still many composers who are interested in the post-war avant-garde and Boulez in particular. I think that the institution where I work is probably not representative of others. It has a particular kind of profile. But there's still an interest. It's just, it's a very, how should I say, it's almost subcultural interest. Yeah. There's a way in which embracing this music marks you as a bit of an outsider. I think that's good for them if that's what they appreciate.
Also, am I wrong, but I get the sense that in US music textbooks, The main musical examples of Boulez that appear are of structures 1A for piano, the first piece of Structure pour deux pianos, livre 1. C'est la seule pièce que la plupart d'étudiants américains rencontrent au cours de leurs études. C'est la pièce la plus austère que Boulez a composée de son catalogue, que même Boulez, je pense, gardait à titre de document important, très crucial dans sa démarche, mais pas celle qui illustre son langage, alors que mes expériences personnelles à présenter des œuvres comme Dérive 1 que nous avons entendu hier, ou Mémorial ou d'autres en classe, sont toujours très positives auprès des étudiants et étudiantes.
Yes, I think that's a fundamental problem in the United States. This ubiquitous presentation of Structure 1A as representative of what Boulez's music was or his style was. And this has kind of proliferated in textbooks and also, I think, through just discussions by scholars who don't really know much of the other music. And I think that's one of the things that I have been fighting very strongly against with my scholarship. Because, of course, Jonathan has done a wonderful job talking about the post-1975 repertoire, but the repertoire between 1952 and 1970 had received almost no attention in the music theoretical literature in the United States until I started doing a lot of work on it. And the response has been really interesting. I mean, I've gotten a lot of emails from composers, from performers who want to work on these pieces, and they say, we finally kind of feel like we have an entryway into the work. I think the situation is very different than in Europe. When I come here and I hear the Boulez performances, they're just so amazing. And it's clear that the performers have internalized this style and this language, but it's not the same in the United States. So maybe this is jumping ahead a little bit to, you know, what is the future? What do we need to be working on? I think for me, this idea.
That's the next one.
Okay.
Excellent. That's the transition.
Yeah.
That's a great transition. Yeah.
I think for me, the most important thing it has been to, or is to try to clarify how the music of Boulez really reflects his aesthetic positions. And in that way, to be able to open up, I think, the discourse and the understanding of the music, particularly the music written between 1952 and 1970. Because we all know that Le Marteau sans maître was tremendously successful, right, when it was first performed. And I think even now, the later works tend to get a little bit more exposure than this piece does. So I think there still needs to be work done in terms of bringing out exactly the qualities of the musical language, the qualities of how this, or the ways that this reflects his aesthetics. And that's something that I'm really interested in working on.
Thank you. So it's perfect to start the second part about the research challenges ahead and the historiography, the evolution of historiography that we should push. And so that's Eddie to start.
So can I just say something though? I was praising Oxford University Press earlier, but one of the most damaging things I think for Boulez's reputation was Richard Taruskin's Oxford History of Western Music. It was completely idiotic of a publisher. Sorry, I'll never get a contract with Oxford. But it was completely idiotic of Oxford to entrust the entire history of music to one person. And he devotes so much attention to Structure 1A, but it's interesting that the approach he takes to post-war modernism, he sees it simply as an epiphenomenon of the Cold War. So basically, Boulez and that entire generation are written off against the background of the CIA, sorry guys, but the CIA flooding money into Europe, the books that have been written about Jackson Pollock, being subsidized, but not to his knowledge. Boulez has been tarred with the same brush that that the Americans allowed all of this to happen, Nicholas Nabokov and so on, allowed all of this crazy music to happen because it would show the Russians just how liberal we were. It just shows you how much has changed, doesn't it, really, since then. Sorry, I felt I had to say that. Anyway, moving on to the future, now that that's off my chest. This isn't in any particular order of the things that I think are important for the future, but I've read a lot of Buleis's correspondence in the Basel Stiftung, in the Zacher Stiftung, and in the Bibliothèque Nationale here in Paris, and it's amazing. The work which Philippe Albera has done recently in producing the Suvchinsky correspondence, which I had consulted extensively, and the Pousseur correspondence, is wonderful because so few of Buleis's correspondences are available. Previously, the correspondence with Cage, the correspondence with André Schaeffner is wonderful and available in English. But we don't have the Stockhausen correspondence yet, which is really integral in terms of understanding the development of music during that period. But there is also shorter correspondences with Ligeti and Elliot Carter, two close friends of Buleis during those last decades of his life. And one of the things you get from this is Buleis's incredible generosity. 3 days ago, I was in the library and I read the correspondence with Carlos Mosley, who was the director of the New York Philharmonic. And this was a correspondence which took place after Mosley had retired from concert organization and Buleis had left New York. Mosley speaks endlessly of Buleis's generosity as a human being, that he never forgot a birthday, an anniversary, and always expressed himself so differently and with such great generosity. It's the warmth of the man that I think has to somehow overtake the technocratic relationship. George Benjamin said to me that he had was introducing Buleis to his students, but their impression of the man was filtered through his earlier writings without them having any understanding of the context that Christian Merlin was talking about earlier on. But just to say, when you go to Basel, there are 20 A4 pages of just names of people that Buleis was in correspondence with, and each of those lines, each of those names opens up into a correspondence of its own. So there's so much really for any one person to really know. So it's a long way before we really have a much fuller picture of Buleis and the totality of his connections. Secondly, the study of Buleis's final scores. This is in no way to deprecate the great work of my analyst colleagues, but we're going through a phase where there's been, for the last maybe 25 years, there's been great work done in the Paul Zacher Stiftung studying Buleis's sketches. In addition to that, it would be wonderful to see a lot of work being done on the final scores as Buleis left them to us, because I think that in terms of helping listeners and scholars to really come to terms with the works as they exist, we really need good guides that really have that really look to the secrets of what's within the score, that give us a deeper appreciation of the things, the reasons why Buleis wanted the pieces to exist in this form rather than in any of the multiple other forms they could have taken.
Eddie, excuse me, just for the sake of time.
Sorry.
As you have 7 points.
Just
keep it quite short.
Thirdly, I will go through the rest very, very quickly. I think we should look. Pascal Descroupé has done great work looking at Buleis's early work in the context of his colleagues, Stockhausen, Nono, Pousseur. I think the same thing needs to be done with the late Buleis. We need to look at what did Buleis learn from Carter and Ligeti in particular in the realm of rhythm and so on. What are the connections between Buleis and the spectralists? Fourthly, what's the connection between Buleis the composer and Buleis the conductor? what the fact that Boulez was conducting Janáček's From the House of the Dead later on, that he was conducting Szymanowski, did any of this have any impact on his own composition and so on? These are just examples. Boulez's great interest in the music of the other parts of the world, and the fact he wanted to be an ethnomusicologist in the 1940s, what he discovered in Latin America, the instruments he brought back from there, the sounds of the harp in Plesal and Plea. There's a lot of work still to be done, I think, in terms of Boulez's engagement with indigenous music from so many other cultures. Looking at Boulez in international context and reception from there, and finally, unearthing abandoned works and older versions of works. This was mentioned yesterday morning as well. The fact that people are now performing the Trois Samedis, the prelude, toccata and scherzo from 1945, the fact that Polyphony X was re-performed, who would have thought, recently in Paris with the Ensemble Intercontemporain and Pierre-André Vallade, the Livre Procuratoire, which is, the work that's been done on the Livre. The fact that there's a version of Explosion Fixe for vibraphone and live electronics, which is being performed here in Paris next month. It's just so exciting. I'm not sure what to think of it, but nevertheless, the possibility that there are other versions and manifestations of Boulez's creativity that we still have to enjoy. Apologies.
Yeah, sorry. I missed this point. Thank you. Thank you, Eddie. Eric?
I would begin by saying that there's a kind of practice in improvisation in the United States, at least, which is you're supposed to adopt the attitude of yes and rather than no, not that. And that's generally the sort of sense in which I'm approaching this. I mean, I think that I would be the first to say that for everything I saw in the past 2 days, all the wonderful presentations, I would just say keep doing what you're doing to a certain extent. I've learned so much in the past 48 hours. That said, I was asked to say what I think should happen, so I guess I have to do that. I would say that, personally, I think one of the best ways to pay tribute to the singularity of a figure like Boulez is to paradoxically desingularize him, put him even more deeply into his, socio-historical, cultural, political, economic contexts. And there are so many ways that this could be done and that remain to be done. I think one way of thinking about this is that a lot of times when this happens, music historians will often approach from the outside in. So to use a term that has been bandied about over the past few days, they treat these contexts as wallpaper, right? As just sort of the background. So we can get to the business of talking about Boulez, the person, or whoever the composer in question is. But I think that there's more that can be done moving from the inside out, right? And thinking about how these figures are articulated to discourses, conversations, dynamics, currents that transcend them. I think this work is already being done, has already been done. So your book on Boulez's interaction with philosophy, Jonathan's work on the sort of engagement with phonographic culture in the 1950s and beyond. I think these are really vital resources and should be developed and models for other kinds of research. I mean, when I was working on my book on music and politics in France in the 60s and 70s, one thing I wanted to talk about but just didn't have space to and kind of ran out of steam and didn't have energy to do was thinking about the ways in which the founding of IRCOM took place against the backdrop of discourses in France at that time about the need to modernize the economy and to move from a kind of older industrial, petrochemical-based economy to a new information economy. And I don't think that something like La Recherche Musicale or an institution like IRCOM would have found the kind of receptive environment that it had were it not for those kinds of concerns, those ambient concerns that were floating in the air. So I think that there's a lot that can be done in that regard. The other thing I would say is that's along similar lines, but moving more towards music is, one big trend in, U.S. music theory is corpus studies, so looking at often large bodies of works and trying to find patterns across them. This can be done sort of, a la main, or it can be done using various kinds of digital automation. Obviously, I think there could be very interesting work that could be done on Boulez's own compositions, though you'd have to obviously take into account the ways in which he recycled material from one work to another that would complicate what kinds of patterns you see across his works. But I think just as importantly is to do that kind of corpus study, putting Boulez in relationship with other contemporary composers. I think it came up in one of the communications today that, the kind of general language of post-war music that he had hoped for never quite materialized, which is no doubt true, but I do think that there's often more commonalities across composers of the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, and beyond, then we often acknowledge in academic research. So just in conversations over the past few days, a couple of things that have come up is there really did seem to be a kind of slowing of the harmonic rhythm beginning in the 1970s and 80s in a way in which, the bloc sonore, served as this kind of object that then, all melodic material would be sort of extracted from. You see that in Boulez, obviously we saw in relationship to Derive, but you see this in the work of somebody like Kaya Zariaho as well, sort of the basis of her musical language. And I think you can see in other composers. I mean, another thing that came up in Catherine's presentation is filtering effects, which Boulez very deliberately composes out with the reduction of a kind of bloc sonore into a single note. But you see similar processes in the music of a composer like Tristan Murail, a piece like Territoire de l'Oubli, where it begins with a big cluster that's gradually filtered out until you just have a single interval that's sort of oscillating. And that's probably a function of the fact that many of these composers were using the same technologies, right? They were all familiar with voltage control filters. So there's, a way in which it makes complete sense that there would be this kind of common elements of a language between them. So those are some things that I think that, research could profit from.
Thank you. So, Catherine.
This one? Yeah. As you like.
You can have both.
Well, I've already spoken a little bit about this, but just very briefly to recapitulate, I feel like Boulez's primary contribution was to eliminate the shackles of the past and reinvent a musical language which offered new ways to think about basic parameters of timbre, texture, space, time, form, as well as pitch organization. And for me, to this points to a meaningful path for future scholarship. I think that Boulez's impact can be measured by studying the way that this musical language opens up paths for future developments. And in order to do this, I think it's crucial, as I mentioned earlier, to understand exactly how his works embody the aesthetic ideals that he espoused. And many of these came into full maturity, I think, in the late 1950s. So that, for me, is an essential path forward.
Thank you.
Oui, alors, bon, je pense que je vais parler en français.
And that will be our final word because, no problem, but we won't have really time for discussion because it would be disrespectful for the musicians and people who have to do the installation. Okay. Yes. So take your time to for your point and then we will follow up the discussion outside, all of us.
Parfait, ça. Mais j'allais juste raconter que pour ma part, une avenue, une perspective de recherche qui pour moi s'est avérée riche, c'était d'étudier la musique de Boulez et ses contemporains dans le contexte du monde, de l'univers de la phonographie, du disque. Juste prendre en compte que cette musique est créée dans un monde où la musique circule grâce au disque et à la radio et au cinéma et existe dans le même monde que des musiques de variété et d'autres, toutes sortes d'autres expériences sonores. Quelque chose que je pense a été beaucoup négligé dans les travaux qui portent sur la musique de l'avant-garde d'après-guerre, comme s'il existait complètement cloisonné du monde extérieur. Et j'ai découvert qu'on pourrait même mobiliser des concepts empruntés à l'étude de la musique, des musiques populaires, de la pop music, dans certains cas, ou la musique de cinéma, et les appliquer à ce corpus. Et parfois, on trouve des trouvailles grâce à cette approche. Un petit exemple en deux secondes qui était le point de départ pour mon livre qui s'appelait Avant-garde on record, donc qui met ensemble le mot avant-garde et le mot record disc ensemble et essaie de trouver toutes les déclinaisons possibles entre ces deux termes. Mais mon point de départ c'était cette œuvre, cette première œuvre orchestrale de Boulez qui est double, cette œuvre de 1958 créée à Paris et qui requiert un changement de la disposition des pupitres de l'orchestre. Donc, les musiciens doivent se placer, comme vous voyez, dans le plan de l'orchestre en trois groupes de vent et quatre groupes de cuivre et cinq groupes de cordes, je crois, en tout cas. Et disons en 58, ma première question de recherche, c'était de me dire, ah, mais tiens, 1958, c'est l'année où arrive sur le marché le disque stéréophonique. Donc les disques 33 tours en stéréophonie, c'est 58, et double arrive en 58, et c'est une œuvre qui fait une utilisation de l'espace insolite. Est-ce qu'il y a un rapport entre ce disque nouvellement spatialisé et cette œuvre qui, même s'il ne mobilise pas un dispositif électronique, utilise ce dispositif quand même spatialisant? Et petite recherche, ah tiens, la réponse est claire et absolument oui, il y a un rapport, puisque Boulez, dans le programme du concert, il fait appel à la stéréophonie pour décrire son choix esthétique dans cette œuvre. Il dit « Nul ne me contredira encore si j'affirme que l'oreille de nos jours exige la stéréophonie dans un désir d'évidence et de mouvement ». Et donc, il rattache sa démarche à la technologie dernier cri, qui est la stéréophonie, et dont ses auditeurs entendaient sans cesse des messages publicitaires à cette époque, dans des revues amateurs de disques et à la radio et dans les journaux. Tout le monde, les compagnies d'appareils audio, incitaient les gens à rejeter leur appareil et d'acheter des chaînes stéréophoniques chez eux. Donc il y avait une campagne de marketing sans précédent, et donc le public forcément percevait cette œuvre qui passait par le prisme de ce qu'il pensait savoir de la stéréophonie grâce à tous ces messages. Souvent, leur compréhension de ce que c'était que la stéréophonie en 1958 était très partielle. Et ça se voyait d'ailleurs, et ça rejoint un peu la conférence de Christian Merlin, mais ça se voyait beaucoup dans les critiques le lendemain du concert, qui se divisaient vraiment en deux camps, les pour et les contre. Mais ce qui était intéressant, c'est que grosso modo, je dirais que les gens pour disaient personnellement, en gros, il disait souvent, personnellement, je n'ai pas entendu d'effet stéréophonique dans cette œuvre, mais c'est sans doute ma faute. Et les contres disaient,
Je n'ai pas entendu d'effet stéréophonique et c'est la faute à Boulez. Donc, bref, je pense qu'il y a d'autres. J'ai convaincu qu'il y a d'autres approches qui pourraient mettre en lien la phonographie avec ce répertoire de l'avant-garde d'après-guerre.
C'est sur ces perspectives d'avenir que nous allons conclure notre colloque. Enfin, il se conclura réellement tout à l'heure dans l'écoute du concert et dans l'introduction qui y sera donnée. En tout cas, je voulais vous remercier chaleureusement tous les quatre d'avoir contribué à ce dernier effort qui nous a, je pense, tous nourris beaucoup pour la réflexion. Je ne sais pas si Pierre-Michel, tu voudrais dire un mot symbolique de conclusion.
Je crois que nous avons bien fait,
juste un toc.
Nous avons bien fait notre travail, Nicolas et moi. Nous avions composé un programme riche et assez varié, et il se conclut merveilleusement par nos collègues qui viennent de loin ou de moins loin, et dont la langue anglaise était parfaitement intelligible. Donc, vive l'international, vive ce que Boulez peut en capter de là où il est, et lui qui était un homme éminemment international. Et puis, nous allons nous reposer un peu. Jean-Jacques veut dire un mot, mais juste un mot, vraiment pas plus, mon cher Jean-Jacques.
Juste une chose qui n'a pas été abordée dans ce colloque, pour aussi remarquable qu'il ait été, c'est un des meilleurs auxquels j'ai assisté dans ma vie, c'est l'étude systématique du répertoire de Boulez comme chef d'orchestre. Et puis l'autre chose, une suggestion que je voudrais faire, c'est aux États-Unis, il y a annuellement des rencontres Schenker ou des rencontres sur la musicologie féministe. Moi, je suggérerais qu'ici au collège ou en France, on prenne l'initiative d'un colloque annuel sur Boulez, vu la quantité extraordinaire de sujets qui doivent être traités. C'est tout.
Et ben voilà, la boîte à idées est ouverte. Donc, merci à tous et merci à nos collègues intervenants qui ont été merveilleux. Et rendez-vous au concert tout à l'heure. Et merci au public et à vous tous.
Et si je me permets, c'est l'occasion aussi de remercier très, très chaleureusement les deux co-organisateurs du colloque. Donc, en commençant par Pierre-Michel Menger et Nicolas Donin.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.